2-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager! That just happened! Thank you very much!
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And welcome once again to the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Gary Hill here. Thanks for being here as we head into what should be a fun weekend. The Mariners taking on the St. Louis Cardinals, something that hasn't happened in a long time. We'll come up with, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, we must review yesterday. Yesterday's loss was just brutal, the way it unfolded. We'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about the road trip that was, and also several other things to get to in this podcast. One, a quick conversation with Jerry DePoto that's pretty interesting with all the moves, recent moves being made. Also, Tom Wilhelmsen will be here, now former Mariner, now current Mariner, as he was signed. So we'll hear from him. And also, I think a piece to perk you up, to cheer you up a little bit. One of my favorite pieces of audio and probably my most requested piece of audio, Dave Niehaus interviewing Ted Williams. It's sensational. It will come up at the end, and it should put a smile on your face in what has been certainly a difficult time for the Mariners. As they lose to the Tigers yesterday, they're swept aside in a four-game series by Detroit. The Astros have now passed the Mariners in the division. The Mariners now below 500 at 36-37. The M's have lost six in a row, 2-8 in their last 10, and will try and turn it around against the St. Louis Cardinals starting tonight. That's not going to be an easy task, and we'll talk about the reasons why coming up. But, boy, the game last night, or yesterday, I guess, in Detroit, and it had a start that was strange and bizarre and one you'd never see.
And welcome back as we go to the bottom of the first inning here at Comerica Park in Detroit. And as we do, trainer Rick Griffin goes out toward the mound to have a look at Adrian Sampson. Sampson had been warming up along with catcher Chris Iannetta, and then they called for Griffin, the head trainer, to come out to the mound, and Sampson is going to have to come out of the ball game.
Oh,
unbelievable. Oh, seeing this play out right now with what the Mariners have gone through over the last couple of weeks with injuries.
So a bullpen that was already severely taxed had to go scheduled to go nine yesterday, as Sampson, he couldn't even deliver a pitch. He goes out during a warm-up. So it really put the Mariners in a bad spot. Tigers built an early lead, but the Mariners start to come back as they play some long ball, particularly Nelson Cruz playing long ball.
Here's the windup and the 1-2 again. Swing and a fly ball deep into left center field. This one is going and going. Goodbye, baseball. Into the Mariner bullpen. Nelly Cruz with a home run, his 17th of the year. The Mariners get on the board, and it's now the Tigers 2 and the Mariners 1 here in the top of the fourth.
And here's a drive deep to left. No question about it. Boom. Stick, baby. Gone. Tie ball game at 4-4. Nelly Cruz, back-to-back appearances, back-to-back home runs. He got a fastball from Rondon and just leaned all over it. Tie ball game at 4-4.
So 4-4 is the score as this game would go to extras. It would go to the 10th inning. The Mariners with a golden opportunity to take the lead in the 10th inning. Well, they couldn't do it. Oh, with O'Malley reaching first base, there was a pickoff throw to first that went by the first baseman down the line. O'Malley scampers to third. So there he is on third base with nobody down. And the Mariners couldn't find a way to punch him home. And then Detroit, with Cishek on the hill, they would win.
Pitch outside, gets past Iannetta. And here comes Maven. That's your ball game. Oh, brother. Tigers mob Maven behind the classic English D behind home plate. They have swept the Mariners, and the Mariners have lost six consecutive games.
And really, no one else to turn to at that point. Carnes was the last man standing. Montgomery unavailable. Everyone else in the bullpen had pitched at that point. Cishek was working on a second inning. Sampson, of course, didn't throw a pitch. Nuno, 3 1/3. Diaz, 1 2/3. Wilhelmsen, Vincent, Benoit, all an inning. Cishek, an inning and 2/3. Carnes was it. He was going to be the guy to go to after that, and he was going to be the last man to throw. And Mariners fall to the Tigers. I would expect a flurry of moves today as the Mariners have a bullpen that is worn. And you look at it now. Keep in mind, the Mariners used 5 starters through the first 2 months of the season. So reliable, such a big key to what was happening early in the season. They're going to use 7 starters in their last 7 games. That's where the Mariners are at right now. The bullpen is being used a ton because they're not getting a ton of innings from the rotation. Wade LeBlanc is going to be the starter today against the Cardinals. 7:10 first pitch from Safeco Field. And the Mariners have to go against Carlos Martinez, who has some of the best stuff in the big leagues. Just straight nasty. Martinez, 7-5, a 3.27 ERA. And he can really bring it. Tomorrow's going to be awesome. 7:10 first pitch. Carnes will actually pitch against Mike Leake, the former Arizona State Sun Devil, at Safeco Field. And it's Turn Back the Clock night at Safeco Field, which is always a great time. Baby blues worn by the Cardinals. Mariners will turn it back to 1984 as well. So that's going to be a fun night from Safeco Field. And then Paxton on Sunday against Garcia, 1:10 first pitch. So Cardinals haven't been in since 02. It has been a long time since the Cardinals were at Safeco Field. Albert Pujols was a young left fielder at that point, so it's been a while. So Mariners and Cardinals for 3 games over the weekend, and the Mariners just looking for a win at this point to break this streak, trying to get back to the winning ways. Now 36-37 on the season. Won't be easy tonight. Let's hear from Scott Servais about last night's game and this recent stretch.
Snake foot is one term you could use, I guess. I thought our guys really, pitching staff-wise, was a phenomenal job today. Just obviously, Sampson walking off the mound before any pitch, you know, we were kind of up against it. But a number of guys are hanging. They took the ball. And they kept really, pitching staff really competed their tail off today. So can't say enough about the job they did. Didn't get it done at the end.
Do you have an update on Sampson at all?
It's an elbow. Discomfort. Felt it in one of those final warm-up pitches, and he'll get looked at when we get back to Seattle. So that's all I got.
Malley going on contact? Before under the second?
Yes. With one out there, and then about, quality of the bat, with the guy on third or in scoring position is something that hasn't been good. We got to get better. We're not going to win many games unless we do. It's hard to hit homers every day. We hit a bunch of them today, but not enough of them.
Is that maybe one of the silver linings, is seeing Cruz come around a little bit and seeing a couple of those guys produce?
Yeah, no, Nelly had a good day, obviously. He looked a little fresher today after the off day yesterday. It's a tough one. That's about as tough as they get. A very disappointing road trip, but, we'll regroup, get back home, get rid of the snake bites, as you termed it, and go from that's about all we can do.
As you regroup, what is your focus in order to kind of turn these around?
I think our ability to compete in those situations, having an idea what the pitcher's going to do against you, what they're looking for you to do, and which is pull the ball on the ground. And that's kind of what we've done lately. So we got to figure out a way to compete, and when you're competing, you got to figure out a way to beat the guy. It's not just trying hard. Everybody tries hard.
Hey, Scott, what was the breakdown in the bottom of the 10th on the error?
Somebody threw the ball in, didn't hit the cutoff man. Obviously, they were not taking the base. They were not going. Hit the cutoff man, and, we're in good shape there, but obviously that didn't happen.
And you feel for Sampson as well. It would have been his second major league start, and he has to walk off the mound before throwing a pitch. Here's what he had to say.
I mean, I felt pretty good in the bullpen. I threw about 35 pitches, and towards the end of it, I felt a little tired. Fatigue for just throwing 35 pitches in a row. Had my little break when we were hitting, and came up to warm up again when I was out there, and just felt a little elbow discomfort in the right side, and there was no pop or anything, but it was just a little discomfort, and I felt the best it would just come out of the game.
Is that anything you felt before or experienced before like that?
No, it was the first time. I had surgery in 2009 when I was in high school, but it's nothing like the same like that was. But obviously it's disappointing to have this right now, and so yeah, just we'll check it out when we get back home and see how it goes.
There it is, Adrian Sampson talking about the start, and now we'll turn to Jerry DePoto. A lot of moves being made, and here's what he has to say about what's going on.
Jerry, two moves today. The first one, let's talk about Tom Wilhelmsson. Obviously, Seattle fans are very familiar with him. You bring him in now. Obviously, he became available, but what do you see with him right now?
You know, the chance of getting him back online. Tom has not lost any velocity. He's still going to top out in the high 90s. He still has the spin rates on his curveball. We feel like the combination of maybe confidence, pitch selection, and just getting him in a comfortable environment where he feels welcome and wanted could help. And, you know, physically he's still very capable, and we just have to tap into that.
Unique situation for him. Did you have an opportunity to talk with him and tell him what's available and kind of get to that with him?
No, we had a very unique turnaround here. I talked with his agent multiple times up to and leading into his flight here. Tom was pretty widely sought after, pretty unique in the way he left the Rangers. Left a lot of money on the table. And I think one of the things that he really wanted to do was return to Seattle. So while we were talking through with his agent, Jeff Kingston was working in the background. We were taking care of the logistics. And we had to bring it together pretty quickly. And Tom had to get on a plane yesterday. So while we were negotiating this, it was less than 48 hours, and we had to get Tom on a plane yesterday in order that he could be here in time to fit in with all the other roster moves we were doing. Otherwise, it could have got very messy.
Now, was that a done deal when he got on the plane, or was that still in the...
Well, he was getting on the plane to be activated on our roster
all
today.
Right.
So he knew that. We weren't quite done with the deal, but he knew it.
Okay, so good to go. And you said to accommodate other moves right now. That's been documented a little bit, but you've got some kind of different things going on right now.
Yeah, we do. Well, one, I mean, we started with, you know, with Wade LeBlanc. Wade is a guy who we are going to add for Friday, and we have to make roster moves to accommodate that. We did send Jonathan Arrow out last night to make room for Tom. There's other things that have to happen in the next 72 hours or so. There's a little bit of a circus going on right now, and we're going to have to make the roster work.
Keeping Jeff Kingston very busy right now.
Yeah, he's definitely on his toes. He's on his toes.
Okay, Wade LeBlanc, you've got a history with, and really phenomenal numbers. I know it's AAA, but when you look at what he's done down there this year, what do you say?
Well, he's pitching as well as anybody in AAA, and Wade has always been the same guy. He's not going to overpower you with a fastball. He's 85 to 90, mostly 87, 88, but he's got a terrific changeup that'll throw in any count, and he's got a really good cutter that'll throw away from the lefties or in on the righties. He's a reverse splits guy who gets the righties out a little better than the lefties, and we felt for our needs, we could trust him to go out there and throw strikes. He has a history in the big leagues. He's actually been a positive WAR player over the course of his career, and a former high-round draft pick who's always performed. He just doesn't throw real hard.
How does one just all of a sudden say, okay, I need a starter on Friday. I'm going to go get him. He's going to be ready on Friday. I mean, it is his pitch day, which is nice, but that's a tough fit.
Yeah, you didn't know there was a starting pitcher tree?
No.
Yeah, Wade actually had an out in his contract like a lot of veteran minor league pitchers do, or players do. He had an out on June 15th. We didn't need him on June 15th down to the minute, but we knew we were leaking oil enough that I did get on the phone and I talked with the people in Toronto and made them aware of our interest, and we were able to work out something pretty quickly once we found out that Taiwan couldn't go Friday.
You said leaking oil, but it sounds like there might be some patches or it might be slowing down a little bit. The news on Taiwan, relatively good.
Really good, and that was very encouraging. He's going to play catch on Friday, and if all goes well, he'll throw a bullpen over the weekend. That goes well, then he slides right back in the rotation next Thursday. No reason to believe at this point that's not going to go well, but the way it's been going for us, particularly with the starting pitchers and their current health, we're just going to keep our fingers crossed and hope.
Okay, and you've been giving the best Felix updates, so I'll go to you for a Felix update as well.
Felix is also playing catch. I think yesterday was the most aggressive he's been. He's starting to get excited and starting to ask questions about when he's going to go out and pitch. So that's all a good sign. Right now what we're planning on with Felix is continued throwing program. Now that he's out of a boot, we're going to determine when it's right to get him to a mound, but don't anticipate it's going to be too much longer until that happens. And again, fingers crossed, right now we're tentatively hoping that he can get out there and make a single start either just before the All-Star break or during the break for one of our minor league clubs. And then as we come back from the break, Felix will be with us and we can have him for the second half.
So hopefully you can slot him right into the rotation. Then.
That would be ideal, and that's what we're hoping for.
Perfect. Anything else going on?
Not that I know of. Not right now.
Perfect. Thank you, Jerry.
You got it, Chad.
And Shannon Dreyer with Tom Wilhelmsen.
So, Dom, it sounds like it's been a crazy week for you, but the last 48 hours, I talked with Jerry and heard that side about what have those 48 hours been like for you?
Just a huge relief and definitely a lot of emotions, but in the last 48 hours particularly, it's been nothing but happiness and comforting. It's been just really good knowing I'm coming home.
One of the neat things is we talked to Scott Servais, and he said he actually did get to know you a little bit last year. He talked to you last year. You were one of the players that he talked with. That has to help with the familiarity because it's really different in there.
Yeah, and, you know, I keep in touch with a handful of guys on this team when I was over there on the other side, and they said the same thing. It's definitely different, but it's a lot of fun and different in nothing but good ways. I sat down with Scott for a little bit, maybe an hour or so, and talked to his philosophy on ball and having fun, being accountable. Everyone's on the same playing field, and then how him and DePoto view playing at Safeco Park and the kind of athleticism that goes along with that. And I think it was just all around just good stuff.
What was it like for you to be back there a couple of weeks ago?
Very special. I was there the third week in the season. That was a little different because I wasn't able to pitch off the mound. Seeing all the fans, I had a great welcoming back. Everyone was real nice and said nothing but great things. So thank you all. And that's definitely part of the reason why Seattle holds a special place in my heart.
Now it sounds like there were a lot of teams interested. Why Seattle and why so quick?
Well, because that's all I've wanted. it was comfort. It was comfort for me. It was comfort for my family. We love the area. And we're just familiar with everything. and having the little bits of success I've had here, it just made sense in my heart.
Also your heart. I mean, the move you made. It's a lot of people are shaking their heads that, okay, you decided to be a free agent. How much went into that and what? Why?
Yeah. It was pretty darn easy. when I first got into baseball, 6, 7, 8 years ago, whenever it was, when I made the decision, it was to be a Major League Baseball player, and that was the kind of mindset and attitude that got me to the big league so quick. I love my family. This is definitely a tough gig because you're away for so long, and there needs to be something with that. So if I'm going to be away from my family for this long, then it's going to be in the big leagues. It's not going to be in the minor leagues. Knowing my track record, not believing in the last 21 outings of this year, I just figured that I could get something done on a major league level, and there's just no amount of money that can buy happiness. Although I have learned that it can get expensive, based off of this, which is kind of funny to say right now. But no, there's just no sense of money comes and goes, and everything in the world is with me. So it was a pretty easy decision.
That's fantastic to hear. And you also bring up, your last 21 outings. You just told us, don't know what happened. You feel good out there. And it sounds like you just turned the page.
That's it. That's all I can do, kind of, laugh about it. Obviously not too hard because it was pretty serious and it put me in this situation. I'm never, ever trying to fail. But you learn from it and kick it behind you. And that's what you do as a reliever, good or bad.
So where are you at right now? It's been about a week since you pitched, and kind of what are you hoping for?
Yeah, I'm hoping to get off the mound today because it has been about a week since I've thrown. I was able to find a fence and a couple of baseballs to keep my arm active and to run a little bit when I was in Dallas. But
you need a dog.
Yeah. But their saliva is quite different than ours, so I don't know if it really helped me so much with the grip on the...
They're better retrievers than a fence, though.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. But I needed to get that conditioning in, too.
Okay.
And so it was a lot easier to do that in 98 degrees with, 80% humidity.
So you feel ready to go.
Yeah, I feel great. I would love to do a little touch and feel off the mound, but, mind, body feels great.
Well, it's great to see you here. Can't wait to see you with a jersey on. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Can't wait.
And to put a smile on your face, Dave Niehaus with Ted Williams.
Ted, first of all, tonight the Mariners open a series against the Baltimore Orioles, and Cal Ripken is 95 games away from one of the greatest records that they said would never be broken. Yep. What is your perspective on Ripken's streak?
Well, it's absolutely marvelous and sensational and tremendous. to play that many games without missing one, I can't hardly conceive of it, because I know that you can get a blister on the wrong part of your hand and you can't play, or you get a little broken little part of your finger and you can't hold a bat, and just so many things. You get hit in the elbow and you can't play. And he's a big, strong guy, and is always in there, and hell, is a great credit to this game.
Your rookie year, 1939, was the year that Gehrig's streak of 21-30 ended. What do you remember about the Iron Horse?
Well, in spring training that year, I had in the clubhouse, we had a little clubhouse in Sarasota, and I could hear, and I was right close to the trainer's room, and I could hear all the old writers coming in, you know, and say, Gehrig doesn't look good at all. You know, he can't hit the ball, and he can't do this. And I said, well, what the hell? He's 38 years old, you know. He's probably over the hill. And, of course, in those days, I think ball players did quit a little bit earlier. They got the incentive to play longer now if they're making $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 or $1 million. You know, that incentive to play is even more more prevalent. And so, but anyway, I saw Gehrig, and I walked up the stairs, up to the clubhouse, followed him, because all the players went up to the Yankee side, then they went over to their side of the dugout. And I remember following him. I never actually met Gehrig, but I was I watched him and looked at him and everything, you know. And, well, if you compare his records with anybody, well, he's right there, and there's no way you can't say, boy, what a player.
Yeah. Another thing before I get into your career that I was just awestruck. I don't know if you remember last year we had a problem up here with the Kingdome when the tiles fell. And,
oh, yes.
And we had to reassume the season at Fenway Park in Boston, and I swear to God, when I die, I want my ashes put under the plate there. But anyway, that's another story. That particular series was picked up in Boston. Everybody was allowed to come in for $10. They had to open the ballpark there on Yawkey Way a couple of hours before, and it was like lemmings swimming to the sea when the kids tried to get those great seats. But at any rate, I remember on a Sunday afternoon after that final game, and I've always been in awe of that red seat out there 502 feet away from home plate. People in line, and they couldn't get them out of the ballpark. It almost brought tears to my eyes as they waited just to sit in that red seat. And I think I was talking to either Joe Gelati or Peter Gammons or somebody like that, and they said, you know, when Ted hit that home run off Freddie Hutchinson, there was no seat there. There were bleachers. Is that true?
No, I think it is true. But they had the seats numbered, because the only way I could tell anybody, or they could authenticate the actuality of it all, was that this guy was sitting up there with a straw hat, and the ball, he reached up the ball, and the ball hit him in the hat and put a hole in, you know, kind of crushed it. And the next day, his picture was in the paper, and they give the seat number and everything else, you know. So Sullivan was there, and I told him about that ball, and I said, all you got to do is check the papers. They'll tell you exactly where the ball was. So what we did this one day, I was just sitting there looking at the park. So he pursued it, and he got exactly the spot. And then they painted the seat red. And that was one of the, that's certainly one of the best balls I hit. But everything was with me, and I got it in the air, and I hit it real good, and the wind was blowing out, and he just kept going. And Freddie Hutchinson was so mad. Ooh.
I'll bet he was mad.
Yeah,
I mean, it's unbelievable
great.
That a man can hit the ball that far.
Yeah, I know. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he really was.
Yeah.
Okay, why did you pick Junior for your first award, your Hitter of the Year award?
Well, we just had to. Here's a young kid I saw him in the All-Star game, the first All-Star game I ever saw him play in, and the first time up, he hit a line drive, low line drive, into left center, left center. And boy, was I impressed the way he hit that ball. And, of course, he just started going from there. He just started to blossom all the way. And I'm really, really happy for him, because his dad was one of the best-liked players, and I didn't even know him, but I knew he was well-liked. And when he said anything, he had a great smile. And then this kid coming along, I can't think of anything that is greater than to see your own kid excel in a sport that you played in. And he certainly is excelling. And I hear more people talk about his hitting, although the other kid is hitting like hell too, Bobby Bond. But they say more about Ken Griffey. Bond has got tremendous talent. But Ken Griffey, geez, tough.
I got on tape, and one of my favorite interviews was the one you did last year with Costas. I thought it was a classic.
With who? Oh, Costas?
Yeah. And your reaction to what everybody has asked you, you've often been quoted as wanting to be known as the best damn hitter who ever lived. And I thought your answer was really great. If you can, as you went through all your records, you said, I don't know, but I know I was one of them, right?
Yeah. I always said, most of the time I've always said that, and I've kept real track of all the hitters because that was my greatest interest in the game. And I've seen them, and I've looked at them, I've studied them, and I've talked to them, and I've asked them. And I want to tell you that my final answer would have to be that, well, I can't say in my own mind, honestly, that I think I was the best hitter. But I said, if they'll put me in a group of Ruth and Gehrig and Simmons and Fox and DiMaggio and Greenberg and Heilman and Cobb, I said, that'll be good enough for me. And I think that that's the way I really feel. All those guys, you know, were the best, that's all.
And you were probably the best of the best.
Well, I don't know about that at all, but I do know that I had a great time writing this book with Jim Prime, the 20 Greatest Hitters. And I'll tell you, that's a tough assignment. I thought, hell, we'll name them off. You can name the first 10 or 12 pretty good. But now you got a group of about 20 in there that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And you really got to separate them analytically as just with every aspect. And the big thing about it is they got a formula now that includes percentage of times on base, and that is a very, very, very big factor. And of course, the slugging percentage is a very, very, very big factor.
One of the great pieces of sports journalism, I think, is John Updike's story about last at bat about God don't answer curtain calls. I was just wondering, when you rounded the bases your last at bat, you'd hit that home run, you went back to the clubhouse. What did you do then? What was going through your mind then?
Well, I was the guys were all telling me to take a bow or do something, and I just couldn't do that. I pretty near thought about tipping my hat, but I didn't. I was emotionally, uplifted a little bit, but I would never come close to doing it. But I thought about it, but when I went back to clubhouse, I mean, I went out to go out the next inning, and then he sent somebody out behind me, and I came in, but. You know, I'm pretty lucky to do that.
Memorial Day is Monday. You served in both World War II and Korea. You lost a lot of your baseball career, by the way, but maybe even a shot at the then-record 714 home runs. But what does Memorial Day mean to you about serving your country?
Well, I'm patriotic, but I'm not Mickey Mouse about it where I'm gushy, but I look back now and I say, well, I'm glad I had a chance to do that. It's an experience that you'd never want to think that you could have it happen, and then after it's all over and you didn't really appreciate until it was all over that you were a lucky guy to get through all the everything that happens to a young player, everything that happens to anybody who goes to the service, anything that happens through life, especially during a war, too, I'll tell you, you got to be lucky.
Mm-hmm. When you entered the Hall of Fame, the things you said, one of the things you said was it was time that some of the great players from the Negro League should
be
in Cooperstown as well.
That was ingrained in my mind way back in 1930, 31, 32, 34. I played in high school. His name was Leo Thompson, and he lived in the littlest and simplest of a little house that I ever saw in San Diego in that area that I lived at. and he was a tremendous little athlete. He wasn't a very big guy, but he was a good athlete. Hell of a little ball player, good little football player, good little boxer. And I've asked 100 times when I've been back to San Diego about, does anybody ever know what happened to Leo Thompson? And I don't know whatever happened to him, but I've asked. And it'd be fun to kind of find out, but he must be an old guy now like I am. And so you never know. Maybe he was in a war. Maybe he had a problem or something. But so I've always felt in my heart maybe a little more thoughtfulness and regarding people that didn't have quite the chance that other people had.
Mm-hmm.
And still, maybe that's one of the reasons I get even a little more bitter when I see riots,
right,
and that type of thing. And I get mad to think that, that things like that happen. But that was a thing that I had ingrained in me a long, long time.
Ted, you won a couple of Triple Crowns in 42-47, yet neither time did you win the MVP award, last man to hit 400. What happened?
Well, you know, I don't know what happened. One time, what was it, 42?
Yeah.
Well, Gordon had the best year he ever had in his life. Yankees won the pennant, and they used to put even more strength on that when they voted for the most valuable player. And that's possible, certainly, to win the most valuable player without winning the pennant. I mean, it's possible to be most valuable player without winning the pennant.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that Gordon, being he was a hell of a player, should be in the Hall of Fame. Jeez.
Right.
And of course, when I didn't get it, when I hit 400, DiMaggio had one of the super great years in the history of the game. And he was truly a great, great, great ball player.
Yeah.
And then the other time, I don't know the other time. Which one's the other time you're talking about?
42-47.
Huh?
1947.
47.
Yeah. Did you win the Triple Crown in 47?
42 and 47?
Yeah.
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 Okay. But I don't even know who got it in 47. Who got it?
Joe DiMaggio.
DiMaggio.
Yeah.
Well, I never felt badly about the year he won the streak and the year that he won the most valuable player. I wouldn't argue against either one of those.
Okay. Now, I want to get your comments, and you read the papers every day. You know what has happened to this game. You know what happened August the 12th last year. You know the resentment that the fans have had. You know that attendance is down 25%, TV ratings are down, and they say it's a dying sport. How about your perspective on the game today and what can be done to rejuvenate it?
Well, I don't think it's a dying sport at all, and I tell you, I can feel, because I had the same feeling. I said, what the hell is going on? What do they want? What does management want? What do the players want? They have representation, and I still feel badly they couldn't get together on it a little better, because the end result was that a lot of fans got turned off a little bit. But this game is so great. This game is so great that it'll get going just the way it was, I'll bet you. And it'll take a little bit of time, because the present player excites the fan to the point where he wants to go to the game. The name that's being created that's a great player or an outstanding player or a stimulation to a city and a locality starts getting the fans worked up, and I think that guys like Bonds and guys like Griffey and guys like that big, I think that big hitting third baseman out there.
Matt Williams?
Huh?
Matt Williams with the Giants?
Oh, yes, sir. Boy, does he rack them. And then you got other guys. Gee, there's a lot of, I see more talent, honestly, I see more talent, I think, than I've ever seen in this game before. I mean, I see catches of cripe. I never saw catches like that. Even, you know, they go straight out and 10, 12 feet and catch one right off the grass.
Yeah, that's
I
true.
I see things. I see speed. I see bodies that are super and talent that's super. And it just shows you that this is a pretty hard game to play the way you'd really like to play it.
Who was the first manager that used the Williams shift on you, and how did you react to it? How did you attack it?
Well, I was hitting just like gangbusters. Boy, I was hitting the ball all over the place. And it was against Cleveland, and I had just won the first game in the 11th inning with a home run. And I was hitting like gangbusters all year, and then when I came out in the second game, they had all kinds of graphs and all kinds of charts to where I hit the ball and where I didn't hit the ball and who I hit it against. And he came out that second game. It was Boudreaux, a great player and a great manager in my book, because he handled the staff all year, and he won the Most Valuable Player Award. I think that's probably one of the most complete years anybody in baseball ever had, because he not only managed, he hit great and he fielded great, and he just carried the whole thing. And I don't think there's ever a player that had a more complete year than he did.
How many times in your career were you asked to bunt, or did you ever?
Oh, I never get the bunt sign. Never. Never.
You never sacrifice?
No, I never got no bunt signs. No, I never got a bunt sign. Never did.
Oh, mercy.
I never got a steal sign. The only time I ever tried to steal, and surprisingly, I think I stole about 35 bases, I never stole. I never got a steal sign. But if I got hit with a ball or something, I'd be mad, you know. Then I'd try to do it. And that's what I must have done most of them, because I never stole any other time.
Would you have done anything differently?
I don't know what I could have done differently. They asked me that the last day I played. And the only thing I said, and I know I was right when I said it, I'd have tried to get stronger. Now, I broke my shoulder, and I'm taking a lot of rehabilitation to try to get it going again. And I know that that exercise is all important. And you can develop stronger shoulders and develop stronger arms, and you can even up your speed with the right kind of training. And I never realized that so much, because until I've had to go through things. And I did say the last day, I said, if I did anything different, I'd try to get stronger, and I know that's right.
Finally,
I would say now, I would add one other thing. I'd say quickness is stronger. Because you're, till the last time you go to bat, you say, I got to be quick, I got to hang in here, you know?
Is it true that your eyesight was so good you could literally see the seams on the baseball?
Oh, geez, I want to vomit when I hear that.
Is that right?
Probably some sports writer thought that.
Yeah. Oh, mercy.
You can't see no seams on the ball. It looks a little reddish, but it's spinning and it's coming in there fast. Hell no, I must have been a frustrated sports writer that couldn't hit.
And also, you know, you've heard this story, too. You've heard this comment, too, and I've even used it on the air in talking about you, about when you were managing both Washington and Texas, that you hated your own pitchers as much as any other pitcher. Is that true?
No. In fact, some of the best friends I've ever had were pitching on that team. Boy, I'd like to see how good we could do today with that team we had. Because it was a lot better team than anybody thought it was. And we started to roll a little bit, and hell, we were playing the last week of the season trying to beat the Red Sox out of position in the pennant race.
Yeah.
Not for first place, but for 3-4-5.
My partner on television is Ron Fairley. What kind of a hitter was Ron?
Ron was a great-looking hitter. He reminded me, he wasn't that big, I didn't think. What is he, 5'10" and 175?
Yeah. Not now, right. But he used to be 175, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But he was a good-looking hitter, and I used to look at him, and even though I didn't play very much against him, I looked at him, and all I could think about was O'Doul, Lefty O'Doul. He was a stylish-looking hitter and a damn good one.
Well, I'll tell you, and finally this, just for my own personal edification, I've got a lot of your memorabilia because you, if my daughter had been a son, she would have been a Ted Williams knee house, by the way. but I have in my game room, in my den, and I'm sure there are thousands of them across America, that picture of you wrapped in the towel at Fenway Park with a bat in your hand. What year was that?
Oh, it was, I would think that it would be in 39 or 40, maybe. Yeah, I'm wrapping the towel, and Christ, I got a bat holding in the locker room.
That's right.
Yeah, and then they got another one of me holding a bat and at the foot of a bed, and now I'm going to hit the leg on the bed, you know. Jesus Christ.
Well, I
didn't have a bat in my hand an awful lot.
One of these days I'm going to get that to you and have you order.
But I'll have a chance to sit down with you.
Hey, Ted, you don't know what a thrill this is, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much. You're a good guy.
See you later!